From the Radio Ranch in beautiful Sugar Land, Texas, where life truly is sweeter, it's the Bombastic Blogcast for Tuesday, January 9th, 2023. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
There yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, and one heck of a nice guy. Let's get things officially started with
the Daily Datagram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. It says, no man really becomes a fool until he stops asking questions. Uh-huh. Was that statement intended for me?
Don't look now, but there's one man too many in this room, and I think it's you.
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of the blogcast.
Twisted history. Gather round, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Sure.
Some cool, some not so cool. Just the same, you need to know your twisted history.
Fine.
You might be quizzed.
Okay. Well, since we've all been warned, let's move along. It was on this day in 1962, as part of the Apollo program, NASA announced plans to build the C-5 rocket launch vehicle, then known as the Advanced Saturn, to carry human beings to the moon. Now, by human beings, they meant American human beings. Right? Got to be clear about that. And it was on this day in 1992, the first discoveries of extrasolar planets were announced by astronomers Alexander Voshan and Dale Frail. They discovered two planets orbiting the pulsar PSR 1257 plus 12. That's how they designated it. To find out where that is, just consult your Ovaltine Super Decoder Ring.
I don't think that's funny.
From DailyJolt.net, in a move that has reignited discussions about the events of January 6th, oh, and they'll be reignited again and again and again, I just know it, a significant wrongful death lawsuit has been filed against the U.S. government by the estate of Ashley Babbitt, the protester, the Air Force veteran who was fatally shot during the Capitol breach. And they're seeking justice and accountability to the tune of $30 million. Now, this case not only brings to light the circumstances of her death, but also casts a spotlight on the shooter, Lieutenant Michael Byrd. Funny, I just mentioned his name in yesterday's blogcast. See, his competence with firearms has been called into question. Now, the lawsuit, which was filed in the U.S. District Court, Southern District of California, paints a picture of Babbitt as a patriot who went to Washington to peacefully exercise her rights. And it alleges that she posed no threat to lawmakers when she was shot by Lieutenant Byrd. Now, he was serving as the incident commander for the House on that day. The complaint details how Babbitt was unarmed, had her hands visible when she was killed without warning or proper assessment of the threat by Lieutenant Byrd. Now, the authorities in Washington have been amazingly mum on this entire incident. I'm sure you noticed that. No investigations, certainly none that we know of. No explanations. Now, the narrative of the lawsuit is one of negligence and incompetence. Oh, I think there was plenty of that on a wholesale basis that day. And they're highlighting several past incidents involving Lieutenant Byrd that raise concerns about his suitability for the role that he occupied. You know, we make a lot of jokes about government competency. You know, in the old, I'm from the government and I'm here to help type of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, notably, the suit mentions an occasion where Byrd left his loaded service weapon in a public restroom, and another instance where he fired at a stolen vehicle, resulting in stray bullets hitting nearby homes. Certainly nothing that should be glossed over. And these incidents, according to the suit, should have served as red flags regarding Byrd's ability to handle firearms responsibly. But moreover, the suit claims that Lieutenant Byrd's police powers were previously revoked due to his failure to meet semi-annual firearms qualification requirements. His peers reportedly didn't regard him as a proficient marksman. And his further questions his capacity or capability to make split-second decisions involving lethal force. The lawsuit suggests also that the Capitol Police, the Capitol Police Board, and Congress, as Byrd's employers, should have been aware of these shortcomings and taken action to prevent this kind of a tragedy. Filing also touches on the broader implications of the shooting, suggesting a double standard in how similar cases are treated, depending on the political affiliations of those involved. And I'm glad they're bringing this up, because this needs to be investigated. It needs to be examined. Big time. It questions why there hasn't been the same level of outrage or demand for accountability as seen in other high-profile police shootings. The comparison to the treatment of Derek Chauvin, for instance, the officer convicted in the death of George Floyd. And this is made to underscore this perceived inconsistency. I don't know that it's so perceived. I think it's blatant. And then adding to the controversy, the lawsuit alleges that instead of facing consequences, Lieutenant Michael Byrd was provided accommodations in a distinguished visitor suite at taxpayer expense and later promoted within the Capitol Police Department. And this has fueled further discontent among those who see this as a miscarriage of justice and a failure to hold Byrd accountable for his actions. Great organization, Judicial Watch. You know them, Tom Fitton and his crew. Well, they're representing Babbitt's estate, and they've expressed its commitment to seeking justice for Ashley and holding the government responsible for what they describe as an awful and unjustified shooting death. And they argue that Babbitt's killing was unlawful and that her family deserves answers and compensation for their loss. So as the legal process unfolds, the $30 million wrongful death suit over Ashley Babbitt's death is going to undoubtedly continue to be a focal point of discussion. Challenges not only the specifics of the January 6th incident, but also the broader issues of law enforcement accountability and the political polarization that can and often does influence the public's perception of justice. In a recent revelation from court documents that have been unsealed, it's come to light that the late pop icon, the king of pop, Michael Jackson, was among the high-profile individuals who visited Jeffrey Epstein's Palm Beach house. Not the island, but the Palm Beach house. Now, this information surfaced as part of a larger investigation into Epstein's notorious activities and his connections with various celebrities and influential political figures. The unsealing of these documents has provided some new insights into the scope of Epstein's network. Among the pages of testimony is a deposition from Johanna Schoberg, a victim of Epstein's, who confirmed encountering Michael Jackson at the financier's residence. Schoberg clarified during her deposition that while she did meet Jackson at Epstein's home, she didn't give him a massage, debunking any speculation about their interaction. The documents also shed a little light on other notable visitors to Epstein's property, including David Copperfield, the magician. According to Schoberg's account, Copperfield was present at one of Epstein's homes where he performed magic tricks for the guests. And this detail adds another layer to the already complex narrative of Epstein's associations with celebrities and public figures. Now, the unsealing of these documents by Judge Loretta Preska marks a significant development in the ongoing scrutiny of Epstein's past and the people he associated with. The mention of high-profile names like Michael Jackson, David Copperfield, underscores the reach and influence Epstein had before his criminal activities were brought to light. And you can't help but wonder why he was doing this. What was he angling for? Well, I think when you read some of the stuff that's already been released, it's pretty apparent that he was angling for power. Perhaps in the interests of blackmailing certain celebrities and officials. But it's important to note that the presence of these celebrities at Epstein's residence doesn't imply any wrongdoing on their part. The mere fact that they attended an Epstein home, a party of you know, just an innocent party or something, doesn't automatically entangle them in the web of allegations. But it does raise questions about the nature of their acquaintance with Epstein. Now, as the legal proceedings continue, it's fair to assume that more information may come to the forefront. This could get really interesting as time goes on. Potentially could reveal further details about the interactions between Epstein and his circle of influential friends. The implications of these revelations are yet to be fully understood, but they certainly contribute to the broader understanding of Epstein's social sphere. The public and media alike are morbidly interested in this, watching the unfolding events as each and every unsealed document potentially holds more clues about the extent of Epstein's connections. The curiosity and concern surrounding these developments are certainly a testament to the gravity of Epstein's case and its ramifications on society's perception of celebrity and power, which these days, gosh, I remember when I was a kid, you used to admire the movie stars and most of your politicians. And today, excuse me, more and people are just, I think this is fatiguing on us. We watch this stuff and we see how crooked people really are. You lose your faith in humanity to a certain degree. Certainly not fun. And the unsealing of these documents serves as a reminder of the hidden relationships between the elite and figures like Epstein. Get how many more people out there like him? You have to wonder. You know, as our society continues to grapple with the fallout of the Epstein affair, you know, it becomes pretty clear that transparency and accountability are paramount in addressing the abuses of power by those in high places. It's going on all the time. I mean, you don't have to look very far to find it. And yes, it's very upsetting. I really have to empathize with young couples who are raising small kids these days. Whatever you do, keep them away from the TV. It was really interesting. My daughter Jennifer and her husband, who live in Richardson, Texas, suburb of Dallas, ever since they've been married, they really have not had cable TV or satellite dish. They get all of their TV off of the internet, and they're very selective as to what the kids can and can't watch. And I like that. And they've got two very happy, very brilliant little kids. Of course, I'm going to say that because they're my grandchildren. But I have to admire the way they're screening what the kids get to see when it comes to entertainment. In fact, those two kids are so creative when it comes to entertaining themselves. Frank Fang, writing for the Epoch Times, says that House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik, who's a Republican out of New York, which is a bit of a, I don't know, that's a bit of an apparition, right? Republican out of New York, but she's good. Anyhow, she said she was open to the possibility of being former President Donald Trump's running mate. Yeah, she was on NBC News Meet the Press Sunday, and she was informed about President Trump's remarks in September of last year when the former president said that he liked the concept of having a female running mate. Given the former president's mindset, she was asked if she would consider the position if called upon. Quoting her, "Well, I, of course, would be honored to serve in any capacity in a Trump administration. I'm proud to be the first member of Congress to endorse his reelection. I'm proud to be a strong supporter of President Trump, and he's going to win this November." You know, I think I'm just about as confident in that as she is. Anyhow, the New York Congresswoman declined to comment when asked about whether she had discussed the possibility with President Trump. She says, "I'm not going to get into the content of my conversation with President Trump. I talk to him frequently. We've been focused on winning. There's so much work to do as the House Republican Conference chair, as the representative for New York's 21st congressional district." She also said, we need to make sure that President Trump is in the strongest position to win in the general election. That's what I've been focused on, and that's what I'm going to remain focused on. Well, media speculation about Trump's possible female running mates have included, but not limited to, Arizona gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake. We haven't heard much from her lately. And then there's Governor Nikki Haley, which I think that is starting to fall by the wayside because there's been so much negativity about her lately. And, Governor Sarah Huckabee of Arkansas, Huckabee Sanders. And then South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. She's kind of my favorite. But I do like Elise Stefanik. She's very good. She's very good. If you go to YouTube and you type in her name and you see the work that she's doing in these congressional panels, holy cow. Now, in December, former White House advisor Steve Bannon predicted that his former boss would pick a female candidate as his vice president. He said, that's Bannon, said Kristi Noem, I think, will be very competitive, given her understanding of the MAGA movement, came out of the Tea Party, very close to President Trump. So later in the same month, Trump Jr. told Newsmax that he opposed the idea of Ms. Haley being his dad's running mate. And I remember this. He says, I would go to great lengths to make sure that that doesn't happen. Nikki Haley wants never-ending wars. She's a puppet of the establishment in Washington, D.C. She's the new favorite candidate of the billionaire class, no different than academia and Harvard, which was an excellent point. And it's a point that kind of echoed what Vivek Ramaswamy said in that last Republican primary debate. Interesting stuff. Now, when pressed to clarify her stance, Ms. Stefanik told NBC again that she would be honored to serve in the next Trump administration. But she added, I'm focused on doing my job right now, which is a really important role as the conference chair and, as most importantly, the representative for the people of New York 21. Then in the news, USA Today, Suffolk University poll released January 4th, 14% of 438 Trump voters surveyed from December 26th to the 29th picked Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as their preferred choice of Trump's running mate. Now, there are rumors, as I mentioned yesterday, that DeSantis is going to drop out of the race. So you have to wonder, could this already be in the works? You know, you don't know. 10% named biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy. I think he'd be pretty good. 7% named Haley. 2% named RFK Jr. 1% named Kristi Noem. And another 1% named former Fox News personality Tucker Carlson. Of course, Carlson has made it abundantly clear he's not interested. And over half of the respondents either didn't have an opinion about it or just refused to answer. That must be kind of frustrating for the pollsters. Young Republican voters wanted President Trump to pick either Tucker Carlson or Ramaswamy as his running mate, according to results from Turning Point Action's straw poll. And that was obtained exclusively by Real Clear Politics. The poll asked 1,013 attendees at the Turning Point USA conference in Phoenix from December 17th to the 18th. It was a spirited get-together, highlights of which you can find on YouTube. But just over a third, or 35% of the respondents picked Carlson, while 25.7% picked Ramaswamy. Now, President Trump continues to be the front runner, solidly the front runner, in 538's GOP presidential primary poll average. And as of January 7th, the average shows the former president with 61.8% support, with DeSantis in second place with 12.1%, which ain't too shabby, followed by Haley with 11.2%. Quick little news blurb here regarding Donald Trump. He announced he will attend the arguments at the Federal Appeals Court on presidential immunity. And he warned Biden that if he doesn't get immunity, then neither will Biden. And he could face indictments over his failures as president. Here's what Trump wrote on Truth Social. By weaponizing the DOJ against his political opponent, me, Joe has opened a giant Pandora's box. I will be attending the federal appeals court arguments on presidential immunity in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, which is today. Of course, I was entitled, as President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief, to immunity. I wasn't campaigning. The election was long over. I was looking for voter fraud and finding it, which is my obligation to do, and otherwise running our country. If I don't get immunity, then crooked Joe Biden doesn't get immunity, and with the border invasion and Afghanistan surrender alone, not to mention the millions of dollars that went into his pockets with money from foreign countries, Joe would be ripe for indictment. By weaponizing the DOJ against his political opponent, me, Joe has opened a giant Pandora's box. As president, I was protecting our country and doing a great job of doing so. Just look around at the complete mess that crooked Joe Biden has caused. The least I'm entitled to is presidential immunity on fake Biden indictments. Pretty good point. And very direct in his approach. Very direct in his language. But yeah, Biden and all the corruption that has come along into the Biden administration with him has managed to paint himself into a corner. I mean, this whole Biden existence is not going to end well. I mean, it's as though they go through life on a daily basis, willy-nilly, doing what they want to do, knee-jerk reactions, idiotic statements like, you know, the greatest threat to democracy is MAGA. You know, come on. And some of the weird executive orders that have come from the Oval Office. You have to scratch your head and wonder, are these people even thinking to one day beyond the end of the Biden administration, regardless of whether it happens next year or 4 years later? And I mean, clearly Biden's health. I mean, he's certainly not going to he's not going to outlive a second term. Of course, I don't think he's going to get a second term. I'm not even convinced that he's going to make it to the election of 2024. You know, this is just, I don't know, this whole administration is nothing but a rogues gallery of incompetent people, people who were hired for nothing more than their DEI qualifications. They're either gay, they're black, they're female. Pete Buttigieg, for instance. I mean, what a showboat this guy is. Crime in his city of South Bend, Indiana, went up 76% during the years that he was mayor. But you look at just virtually everybody in the Biden administration. They're incompetent. They're failures at what they do. Look at Alejandro Mayorkas, DHS secretary. Come on, really? And we've got 10,000 illegals pouring into our country every single day? Oh, man. I'm almost afraid of what this country is going to be in 20 years. It's going to be different, I can assure you that. Now, to what degree? I don't know. Nobody does. And maybe that's a good thing. Looking at pro-Trump news here, I see the smears of the mainstream media are failing. A new report from Newsweek discusses the possibility that Donald Trump could get more black votes than any Republican in history. Here's how Newsweek put it. Donald Trump may win more black votes than any other Republican presidential candidate in history in the upcoming presidential election. According to national and swing state polls reviewed by Bloomberg, the former president and GOP frontrunner has between 14 and 30% of the black vote share as the country heads into an election year. This is far beyond the 8% of the black vote, the Pew Research Center said the Republican won in the 2020 election, and more than any Republican candidate before him. The NAACP estimated that 5 million African Americans voted in the 1960 presidential election when Richard Nixon won 32% of the black vote, according to Politico. Since then, the black population has increased from around 10.83% or 19 million 418,190 people, according to an analysis of census data, to 13.6% of the overall population, or 46,936,733 people. A poll taken in December found that Joe Biden is losing support from black voters. Well, of course. Then USA Today reported, though President Joe Biden won support from 92% of black voters in the 2020 presidential election, the base could be shrinking ahead of the 2024 race for the White House, according to a new survey. A survey from Gen Forward released Tuesday found that if the presidential election were held today, 17% of black voters said they would cast their ballot for former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, 20% of black voters polled said they would vote for someone else other than Trump or Biden, and 63% of the voters said they would support Biden. Now, black voters are also split on whether Biden should run for president, with 15% saying he should definitely or probably seek another term, and 49% saying he definitely or probably shouldn't run. The survey was conducted among 3,448 voters. That's a big sampling for most polls. From November 8th through 20th, with a margin of error of plus or minus 3 percentage points. So, there you have it. Not hard to understand the rationale behind that, right? President Trump is going to do real well. Let's head on into the comedy corner. We need some laughs, and you get them with Bobby Tessel.
I had some good fortune the other day. I won $50 in the instant lottery. It was very exciting, so I quit my job. I took the annual payments. Before the show, I was walking down the street and I saw a guy walking away from his car and his lights were on. So I said, "Hey, sir, you left your lights on." And he looked at me, he goes, "My lights go off automatically." I was like, "Oh, wow." Mine do too after 6 hours. I didn't pay extra for that. Driving to the show tonight, I saw a sign for a sign store called Signs for Less. It was handwritten. So I'm watching the movie Goldfinger. Not right now. It's an old James Bond movie, and there's a scene in the beginning of the movie where James Bond makes love to this woman. He leaves the room, he goes to the kitchen to get some champagne, but he gets knocked unconscious. When he comes to, he goes back to the room. The woman is lying in the bed. She's been completely painted gold, and she's dead. That's happened to me twice. I don't understand why we get popcorn at the movies. Every time we get popcorn, we get the pee stuck down in our teeth, and we're sitting there for the whole movie flicking it with our tongue. We can't get it out with our tongue, so we stick our finger down in there to get it. But for some reason, we have no tongue-to-finger perception because we can't find it with our finger. We actually have to find it again with our tongue and then follow our finger on our tongue. A friend of mine recently broke his ankle playing hockey, and about 6 months ago, I broke my ankle playing basketball, but mine was really stupid because I was in an arcade playing that Papa Shot game. Last time I played real basketball, I was guarding a guy who was a lot bigger than me. He was like pushing me around and shoving me, so like one time he was backing me down the court, I just kind of licked him. He didn't cross half court after that.
Make it a terrific Tuesday. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's Bombastic Blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And you be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?
See you tomorrow, G-Man.